Of time in quantum gravity and cosmology, and we are here at Perimeter, and there's also a group of people at Western. Hi there. Can we hear you if you talk? Somebody say something over there. We can hear you. You're not that loud, so you'll have to speak up. Okay, and I apologize. Apparently, the quality of the video conferencing is not ideal at this moment. So you can either see me, apparently, or you can see the screen, but not both. So we'll work with it. They will be switching between them. This is a bit of an unusual class. This is partly a class in physics, and I will be giving what I think is the basic background in physics to follow the discussions going on the nature of time in quantum gravity and cosmology and so forth. This is also, there will be aspects of the class which are philosophical, and let me emphasize that I'm a physicist and I'm not a philosopher, but as I'll show you, in fact, I think we can switch. Can we switch? Let's see. That's interesting. There. The course will be in roughly three parts. The first, which will be probably 60% of it, will be an introduction to the topics in physics within which the problem of time is most often discussed, and that's the physics appropriate to discussing the quantization of gravitational theories. So it's Hamiltonian dynamics of constrained systems. And towards the end of the discussion today, I'll be telling you more about what that involves and how to study it. The second part of the class will be the historical and the philosophical background for the problem of time. I will not make claims to be either a historian or a philosopher, as I said. So this will be history and philosophy with a light touch. We will have at that point also some guest lectures from people who are qualified to or more expert in those areas. And then the third part of the class will be a discussion of and a critique of various discussions going underway now, various proposals for resolving the problem of time. And I haven't yet told you what the problem of time is, but that's the purpose of this lecture. So that's the rough outline of the class. There is a detailed syllabus, so let me pass it out. And I emailed it. Did somebody over there at Western get it? Hello? Oh, okay. Okay, it will be at the, I will be discussing the detailed syllabus at the end of the discussion today. Let me also say that normally this class will go till 10 o'clock with the break in the middle. Today we're going to go to 8:15 or 8:30, both because this is an introductory lecture and everybody who wanted to be introduced to this may not want to stay for 3 hours. And also because, unfortunately, I have to be tomorrow in Montreal, and there was no way to get there from here, leaving here at 10 o'clock. But I think it's also appropriate for that. Let me ask, before I get started with the introductory lecture, how many people here and at Western are philosophers or philosophy students? Okay, so we have the the chorus of philosophers from Western. Be kind to us. How many people are mathematicians? Okay. How many are physicists? Okay, and how many are something else? What's the something else? Electrical engineering. Okay, very good. If and I'll come to discussing the prerequisites towards the end. Basically, if you're a graduate student in physics and you're interested in the topic, then I think you have the prerequisites. The prerequisites are basic quantum mechanics, basic mechanics, but at the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian level, some general relativity, some electromagnetism. If you're a philosopher, everybody's welcome to listen, but in terms of taking the class, if you're a philosopher and you have questions about your background, then please discuss with me. And if you're an undergraduate as well and you have questions about the background, please discuss with me. Mathematicians, if you don't have the specific background but you're willing to read and learn quickly, you're very welcome. Because what we will do will not be mathematically that sophisticated. Okay. What I'm going to do today is a kind of introduction to the problem. But before I do, any questions? Let me see if I had anything else. So there are the prerequisites. As far as those taking the course, this is treated as an advanced graduate course. So the way that assignments and grading will do is that I'll be indicating reading as we go along in the topics, which I hope that people will do. I'm also happy, because we're a diverse group, to suggest backup material or material to catch up, both on the physics side and the philosophy side when we get to it. The only assignment in the class is a research paper, and I would like by a month from now, everybody who is taking the class to have discussed with me the topic, the possible topics of the research paper. Okay, so make an appointment. If you don't have my email, this is my email. And I don't know if I have to write out the rest of it here, perimeterinstitute.ca. Okay, and I'm very, very happy to talk to everybody. I won't have formal office hours, but I'm very happy to make an appointment to see anybody anytime. I'm very happy to correspond by email, to talk on the telephone, et cetera. Okay. Now, any questions about, yes? We'll see. That's we have in the past done presentations. We will probably do presentations, but my sense is that the main thing for the assignment is the written thing, especially since I want people to do really good, serious work on something related to the thing. So we may have, depending on time, we may or may not do presentations. It would be fun. We did them before, but the assignment is a paper. Okay, other questions? Okay. Questions from Western. Okay. Let me start the discussion by quoting from some people in the political process in New Hampshire a few days ago. This is personal. and what? Yes, and it's personal for me because the issue of time and the nature of time, both generally and in the particular context of quantum gravity and cosmology, has been a central concern and a central interest of mine throughout my scientific life, really since college. And it's a central concern of mine right now. As you'll see from the introduction, I'm struggling with some issues related to the question of time and related issues myself in this period. That's why I wanted to teach a course about it, to have a chance to be focused, further focused on the issue. I'm involved in a collaboration with a philosopher, Roberto Unger, with the goal of writing a manuscript, perhaps a book, on the subject. And so this is, for me, a central issue. So what I want to be doing in the course of this class is two things. One of them is equipping everybody in the class with the background to tackle the problem. Because the problem, there are ways in which the issue of the nature of time arises directly without any mathematical formalism or physical theories. And that's some of that I can talk about today. But the way in which the problem is studied and attacked these days is in the context of theories of quantum gravity and theories of cosmology. It both is attacked within those theories and it arises, different aspects of it arise out of them. So I want to teach the background to tackle the issues. And that's the first part of the class. But I also want with you to struggle over the issue, to argue, to go back and forth, to try out ideas, because the problem is unresolved. So I hope that the class will have both aspects. And if my opinion ends up being changed in the course of it, then that will be a great thing. Hopefully it will be of even more value to you. Okay, so please, what I'm going to do in this introduction is set up what I think are the key questions, and even as we then go through material in, you know, Hamiltonian dynamics, quantum gravity, cosmology, etc., and go through the technicalities of that material, I want to keep focused on the issues that I'm going to be presenting right now. Okay, so let's go. I wonder why this is, okay. Okay, there's a detailed syllabus, but I will come back to it. Okay. There is a popular view among physicists, and you hear this all the time if you attend seminars or read the literature in quantum gravity or in cosmology, if you hear people grappling with the vast landscape of physical theories or read people trying to make sense of eternal inflation. You hear all the time that time is not real, that time is, quote, emergent, that time is an epiphenomenon. And what they mean by that is that in the fundamental laws of physics, as applied to cosmology, and let me emphasize that, as applied to cosmology, time does not appear. There's no quantity associated with time which appears in the fundamental laws, in the statements of the fundamental laws. And that's a true statement. If by the statements of the fundamental laws you mean a Hamiltonian approach to the quantization of general relativity or related theories, that's a true statement. And that's shocking and provocative when you first hear about it, and to me it's shocking many years after hearing about it. There is an opposing view, and I should say that view, the view that time is not real, that change is an illusion, of course goes way back in the history of philosophy. To philosophical considerations in philosophy. So it's not a new view, but it's a view which has a certain technical argument in support of it. Now, there is an opposing view, which is that time is real. And what's meant by that, because there are a lot of things, and as we'll be discussing as we go on this, there's a lot of things we mean by time. There's a lot of aspects of physics and phenomena that are called time. And we'll be careful to distinguish them. But what I'm talking about here is the sense in which our experience is structured as a succession of moments. At the moment we are experiencing, I assume nobody here is a robot or a zombie, since I don't believe in the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, and according to which almost everybody else in any room is a zombie if you're not. I don't believe that you're zombies, so we're all experiencing, and what we're experiencing is sometimes called the stream of consciousness, the flow of time, the succession of moments. Okay, these are all different ways to put words around a central aspect of our experience of nature. Okay. Now, if physics is supposed to be a description of the natural world that explains and accords with our experience of the world, then there's two possibilities. One of them is that physical reality is also structured as a succession of moments, in which case there's little to explain. And with this, that case, we perceive the world, at least in that aspect, as, quote, it is. The other possibility is that the people who believe that time is not fundamental in the world are correct, in which case one has to explain how it is that we experience the world in a succession of moments. And there's a variety of attempts to make that explanation, and one of the things we'll want to do is look at the adequacy of those attempts and see if they succeed or not. No. Thank you, Sean. Okay. It may certainly be true that even if in the canonical formulation of quantum general relativity and other theories, time, quote, disappears, okay, that may or may not be true. Okay. We're going to critique that. We're going to study that carefully, because even though that's said and written all over the place, it may not be true. Okay. But even if it is true, it may be that that's just not a correct description of nature. Okay. And that's definitely on the table. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I have my own view, and it will be clear. First of all, you probably know it, Tidana, as well as anybody, but it will become clear as this talk goes on what my view is. Okay. But I want to be as harsh on my view, at least as harsh, if not harsher, on my what happens to be my own view currently than on all the other ones. Okay? So the point of this class is not for me to indoctrinate you with the one true view about the nature of time. It's quite the opposite.
Whatever happened already, I mean, in the past, just still existed. And or they just disappeared, or they're
relevant. There's a great set of questions about the status of the present, the status of the past, and the status of the future, and we will discuss them.
We will especially when we come to the philosophical part, because those are all important questions. And there are views, you can find views that, you know, the present is real, the past is real, and the future is not. It's all real. You can find various views. Okay, so this just says, what I said before, in this class we'll discuss these contrasting views and other views with an aim to critiquing them, and as well as understanding the relationship of the philosophical views to the technical issues. So let me emphasize this, okay? Because this is my view. Okay? My view is that the philosophical issues and the philosophical history is important for thinking about these questions as a physicist. And my view is also that the technical issues that physicists and mathematicians confront trying to make models and theories of cosmology are also very relevant. And my view is that nobody has a convincing solution to these issues, in my view, but my view is that whoever comes up, whatever trend or research program or group of people come up with what becomes the solution, because I'm an optimist, I believe problems get solved, will come from thinking simultaneously about the issues raised in the philosophical literature and being in control of the technical issues in the theories where the issues are discussed. So that's why I'm doing this class this way. Okay, so why is time of interest? Well, it's of interest for itself, but why is it of interest for a physicist working on fundamental physics, or why is it of interest for a cosmologist? The hardest problems in contemporary physics and cosmology, in my view, involve time. the problem of quantum gravity, of unifying general relativity and quantum mechanics, or finding another theory, whether it's, you know, string theory or M theory or group field theory or causal sets or whatever, that is some other theory that has as appropriate approximations classical general relativity and another appropriate approximation quantum mechanics, whatever is the right theory of nature that combines these, for reasons that we will discuss, it's clear that a central problem, a central difficulty, is that quantum mechanics and general relativity have very different notions of time. And time is treated conceptually and mathematically very different in the two theories. So no matter what successes one has on technical aspects of quantum gravity, string theory, whatever, one always comes back to the really hard problems. And in the really hard problems, one sees this clash of notions of time. A related issue, which we'll spend some time on, is the issue of what's an observable quantity. In physics, the observers and the experimentalists measure and observe things which are, by definition, observable. They're things that they can construct instruments, and we heard a beautiful talk today about that. They construct instruments and they measure things, and they give us, you know, measured functions, measured relationships. Presumably, what they're measuring corresponds to quantities in physical theories which are observable. And that means quantities in theories that are observable. And most of the quantities in the theories that are of interest in contemporary life are not observable. And this is as a result of the gauge invariances and the diffeomorphism invariances. It's not true, as it was in Newton's time, that you could write, you know, a vector for the position of a particle at time t, and that was observable, and that's what the theory dealt with, and that was more or less all there was. Okay. We deal with, you know, functions like gauge fields as a function of space and time, or, you know, the metric as a function of space and time. Those are not observable quantities. The coordinates are not defined, because we can work with any set of coordinates, and that's a whole issue we'll have to deal with. So what are observable quantities in theories of gravity? And that's a central technical issue. There are certain, as we'll see, certain technical criteria that an observable has to satisfy, and we'll see that it's very difficult to satisfy them in reality. Okay? People can make little models. Okay. So, and what's going on over and over again in the work that attempts to define what an observable quantity is, example work by Carlo Rovelli and Bianca Dietrich here, is this conflict between, or possible clash between, the notions of time in quantum mechanics and general relativity. Sure.
Time and space.
Oh, this is cool. Time is harder than space, but I mean, okay. Every question, that's a good question too. That's a very good question. Okay. We'll talk about space later on, because I think space is solvable. Mm-hmm. That is, I think if there was no time, okay, if it was just a question of making observables that lived in space that were sensible, I think we actually know how to solve that problem. Okay. In a way that we don't know how to solve the problem. There is an issue with space, but I think it's solvable. Okay. And therefore, it might or might not be. It might be a model for how we should approach the problem of time, or it might be very misleading. Okay. One of the things is relativity joins time and space. Okay. You know, but we'll, again, these are things that we'll be dealing with. Relativity, quote, joins time and space, but not really. I mean, a manifold with a Lorentzian signature is a very different object than one with a Euclidean signature, as it will be discussed. And woe be to those who try, and they're the same, trying to make theories of quantum gravity based on it. You've wasted a lot of time. There are also simple-minded issues that are so simple-minded that they're embarrassing to talk about, but they're profound. Like, you know, the current day cosmology has, quote, the Big Bang, a quote, first moment of time. That raises a lot of issues. Like, what are the initial conditions? Or, you know, how do the initial conditions get coded into, quote, the first moment of time? What were the laws of nature doing? If you think that laws of nature are eternally true, what were they doing before the universe started? Just sort of sitting around in some waiting room for, you know, a universe to come along to govern them. On the other hand, maybe it's an old idea that when you combine general relativity with quantum mechanics, that quantum effects remove the initial singularity, and there's a time before the Big Bang. And there are theories that people work with. Some people in this room know it very well and work with them. For the information of the philosophers, they really, really do work with dynamical theories of the universe before the Big Bang, how the universe made a transition from some other state before the Big Bang to the present state. There are attempts to derive observable quantities and compare them with measurements in those things. Okay. And there are lots of issues that those attempts to discuss physics before the Big Bang raise. But I'm just making lists of issues now. Yes?
We tell that there must have been a Big Bang. I mean, it's just the universe must have been very small, but that doesn't say it was like some quantum mechanical.
What you can do is, if the laws of physics include general relativity coupled to matter, which satisfies certain positive energy conditions, then there was
an initial singularity. That's a theorem.
Okay?
Yeah. So, say, for example, I mean, the Big Bang is the first moment of time. Doesn't have any meaning that we say what was the before the Big Bang? Because if it is the start of time, it doesn't mean that we say that.
No. So, what that means is.
I can't say with someone else, because for the universe, nobody can say, okay, what is out of the universe? Because all this everything is universe.
No, but this is meant in a simple-minded way. What's meant by before the Big Bang is that the moment of time that general relativity, following those singularity theories, predicts is a time before which, and again, we'll discuss technically what it means to say that there's a first moment of time and a solution to general relativity. But what it means is that the dynamics is different, the laws are different than the ones that, than classical general relativity in such a way that when you use those different laws, you can evolve backwards through that time that was the singularity. It's not a metaphysical thing like other universes. Okay. Okay. A key question that, to my understanding, becomes quickly involved in the question of the nature of time is the question of the nature of the status of the laws of physics. Okay. Many people have this naive idea that what we're looking for as physicists is the discovery of laws which are somehow outside of time, external to time. They hold, quote, for all time, they're eternally true, quote. They hold whatever is going on in the universe, but even if there's no universe, in some sense, they're true. What does this mean? And is this a coherent idea? The idea that there's a universe that evolves in time, but the laws do not evolve in time. And notice time is coming in every sentence discussing the status of the laws. So it's intricately involved. Do the laws transcend time, which is, I think, a common metaphysical view, that the laws are prior to anything that goes on in time? Or do laws evolve in time? There are now hundreds of papers in the physics literature about the possibility that the laws evolve in time. This is the so-called issue of the landscape, that there may have been, that there's a vast landscape or space of possible laws, and that there is a vast collection of universes, the so-called multiverse, and that universes give rise to other universes through physical processes, or all the universes
are born in some big eternally inflating state. And the result of this is that different laws hold at different times. And so what's there is sort of a picture in which laws don't have this transcendent status. A law is something that governs a particular region of space and time, which is called a universe. And that notion is very widely studied these days. Okay, let me finish before I'm sure that everybody has a lot to say about these things, but let me lay out the issue and then we'll talk. Okay. So maybe it's the other way. Maybe in some sense time is more fundamental than laws. That is, if time is real, of course, if time is not real, then this doesn't make any sense. If time is not real, and you still want to think about a multiverse, say in the style of Leni Susskind or Andre Linde, then you have to think about a timeless ensemble of universes. Okay, and you know, and we want to examine that. Does that make real sense? Is that a game, or is that science? And can that be made real sense of? Okay, or if we want to talk about laws varying in different regions of the universe, must we be talking about laws varying in time, in which case we can't have a picture of what a law is as something that's outside of time. Okay. This is the question. Right, so you have a view, and your view is that there's a complete theory, a so-called ultraviolet complete theory, which is eternal, and that in different, and it's a kind of meta theory because in different regions of space and time, it manifests itself in many different phases, according to which it appears as if different laws are governing. Okay, it's a common view. It has been at times my own view, and I think we need to critique the view. I'm not in this opening lecture. I'm not going to advocate a view. I'm just indicating A, that there are issues, and B, that they're really tied to the issue of the nature of time. That is, if you believe that time is emergent, is not fundamental, you approach these issues very differently than if you believe that time is always real and is always present. Quick. We'll see if it has a meaning or not. Okay, we'll see. I don't think it's a matter of definition. Let me develop, okay? Let me develop, okay? Yeah. That's the key question. Is there a quote meta law? Yeah. Yes. And now let me ask you another question. Supposing you have a proposal for that meta law, and I have a different proposal for that meta law. Okay, is there a falsifiable prediction that you and I can make to tell which quote meta law, okay, is governing the changes between the law in our present universe and laws in other regions of space and time? I'm not sure. And if there isn't, then what is the scientific status of the claim that there's a meta law if you can't test it? Okay. Because again, I want to distinguish between fantasies that is making beautiful metaphysical fantasies and things that we can do as scientists. And I don't think that line is the philosophically interesting things are in the class of fantasies and what we can do is pragmatic and mundane. I think it's quite the opposite. Okay, so now you ask me my view. My view is that the fantasies are philosophically naive and thinking carefully with the help of the history of philosophy will help us do science with these questions. Okay, related to this, I'm going to go on this theme for a few more minutes. One way to talk about this is What's the task of physics? The task of physics used to be, what are the laws of nature? Well, we almost know what the laws are. There are certainly things that we don't know. That's one reason why there's an LHC. Okay? But we know, you know, in a large domain of phenomenon encompassing many orders of magnitude of distance, time, and energy, we know what the laws are. The next question that arises, therefore, is why these laws and not others? That's becoming the central focus. And that's really what a lot of us are doing in fundamental physics. That's what a lot of string theorists are doing. That's what a lot of people in quantum gravity are doing. That's what the whole argument over the landscape and so forth. It's not about what are the laws, it's about why these laws and what kind of explanation is suitable. When you ask, is that just like, is it like the question of what are the laws, or is it different? And is it different in ways that we better know or we'll get confused? Okay. And again, okay, what is the role of time? That's my persistent theme, that to seriously address these issues, you have to think about the role of time. Because whether you think of the world as fundamentally timeless or not, completely changes the way you approach this question. Okay, so this is my friend Roberto Unger. So I've been forgetting to say this, but now I'm pointing to the screen, who is a philosopher, and here is a provocative thing that I'll just read that he wrote about these issues, which is a certain point of view which is counter to the most common points of view among physicists. So Unger says you can trace the properties of the present universe back to the properties it must have had at the beginning. That's what our cosmology friends are always doing. But you cannot show that these are the only properties that the universe might have had. Earlier or later universes might have had different laws. To state the laws of nature is not to describe or explain all possible histories of all possible universes. Excuse me, that's precisely what I thought to state the laws of nature was. I can make that. That's what it means to have a configuration space and a space of solutions is to discuss. Okay. Unger claims only a relative distinction exists between law-like explanation and narration of a one-time historical sequence. Let me point out what's going on here is a theme I'll come to in a minute, which is that there's a big difference between the role of laws of nature when we're talking about experiments in the universe, within one laboratory, within one solar system, within one galaxy, right, and between talking about the entire universe, where there is only one example of, which contains everything, so there's no laboratory outside of it, there's no observer outside of it, there's no clock outside of it, there's no multiple experiments to check things by relative frequency. And in cosmology, we're running into these issues, that the fact that trying to attack cosmology scientifically raises some new issues because there's only one case. Okay. Let me just go on here. If you were asked what you mean by the necessity of the laws of nature, that is to say, why are the most necessary relations necessary, you can legitimately respond only by laying out the substance of your cosmological and other scientific ideas. People who appeal to fixed conceptions of necessity, contingency, and possibility are simply confused. Okay? So that's a counter point of view. Okay? And one of the things that I want to do is highlight why trying to address problems in cosmology puts us in dangerous waters where these become reasonable thoughts. Okay. And by the way, this was written in about 1990, so it precedes the similar discussions in physics about the landscape of theories and so forth. That's another issue. Okay.
You're trying to say.
I'm not trying to say anything. I'm just trying to provoke you.
Okay. So then what about the possibility of the laws changing, but there is no metaphysical laws dictating how those laws change?
No meta laws, we'll discuss that in time.
So that would just mean that the universe is not really logical at all?
No, maybe that means the universe is very logical. But let's wait for the discussion.
Okay.
Maybe it's illogical. Let me put it this way. What's the present status of what most of us believe? Most of us believe there's some law of nature. It has some space of solutions. It has some configuration space. We choose the initial condition, and then everything is determined. Okay. We're completely unable to answer the question, why these laws rather than any other? And we are certainly, even if we could answer that, we're completely unable to answer the question, why these initial conditions and not others at the cosmological level. Moreover, we are pretty confused about what things we see in the sky are the consequence of laws or initial conditions in the early universe. Given, for example, there was a paper on possible observation of non-Gaussianity. So it's non-Gaussianity, for people who don't know, is something very bad if you believe that the explanation of the cosmic microwave background is inflation. Okay, it's correlations that should not be there. 3-point and higher point correlations that should not be there. There's a claim, 3 sigma, 2-point something sigma observation of non-Gaussianity. Okay. I don't know, what was this, 3-4 weeks ago, something like that? There already are papers attributing it to unusual initial conditions before inflation, and there are papers attributing it to little glitches in the law of the inflaton status. Okay? So supposing somebody comes to you and somebody has a proposal to explain this observation, assuming it's real, by changing the initial conditions, and somebody else has a proposal to deal with it by changing the laws, and we have one experiment. Are you going to be able to distinguish between them? Okay, that's the kind of thing that I worry about. Okay, and that's because of worrying about that, I'm susceptible to the kind of provocation.
Okay, that we talked about.
Okay, let me come back to the issue of time, okay,
so that's, I've been provocative for a little while about the nature of laws, that's enough on the nature of laws. Let's come back to the issue of time. And again, there is a view, the reality of time. This is just, I want to emphasize strongly what it means if you believe this. Everything that exists or is real exists at a moment, which is one of a succession of moments. In each moment, all that is real at this moment is what exists at this moment. So this is a view that says the past is not real now. Okay? Versus the unreality of time. Okay? A view, an often advocated view that, and it's not even in quantum gravity. After all, there's the block universe point of view that what's real about a space-time is the entire solution of the Einstein's equation. What's real is the whole 3+1 dimensional space-time, the world lines in it, which are, the paths of atoms. Do we have any colored chalk? There's a little green bit in which I'm alive, in the world line, and so forth. So this is a common view, both among physicists and philosophers, that there's no reality to what exists in a space-time at any moment. What's real is the whole four-dimensional space-time. Okay, that's the dilemma. I just want to focus us back on the central dilemma. Okay, now the argument between these is old. We're going to much later in the course look at some of the literature in the argument. But there's a nice quotation by philosopher Carnap, one of the important philosophers of the 20th century, important philosophers of science, from his autobiography in 1963. And he's writing about a conversation he had with Einstein over the issue of time. And let me read this quote because I think it's a very interesting quote. And it will focus us on different issues that I want to talk about next. Okay. So once Einstein said, that the problem of the now, that is the status of the reality of right now, worried him seriously. He explained that the experience of now means something special for human beings, something essentially different from the past and the future, but that this important difference does not and cannot occur in physics. Basically, because of what I just said, that in physics, if I say, you know, the right theory, supposing the right theory is general relativity plus the standard model, I know it's not ultraviolet complete, but just suppose for a minute, okay? Then a description of nature in general relativity coupled to matter fields is a space-time, and that's what's real. Okay. What's now, the fact that that's a moment that I'm experiencing right now on my world line, doesn't play any role in the statement or the solution of the equations of general relativity. That's what Einstein means. Okay? That this experience of the now cannot be grasped by science seemed to Einstein a matter of painful but inevitable resignation. I remarked to him that all that occurs objectively can be described in science. On the one hand, the temporal sequence of events is described in physics. That is, you know, here's, you know, me getting up this morning, here's having a cup of coffee, here's the moment right now, here's getting on the train tonight, etc. Okay, that's all in there. And on the other hand, the peculiarities of our experiences with respect to time, including our different attitudes towards past, present, and future, can be described and in principle explained in psychology. It's a remarkable assertion, and I think we later want to come back and ask, huh? How? How is psychology, you ever talk to any psychologist? How is psychology supposed to explain that? But Einstein thought that these scientific descriptions cannot possibly satisfy our human needs, that there is something essential about the now that is just outside the realm of science. And that's a very provocative view for those of us who think that science is going to give us a complete description of reality. And it's weighty that this was apparently Einstein's view. Okay. We both agreed that this was not a question of a defect for which science could be blamed, as Bergson thought. So Bergson, the philosophers I'm sure know of Bergson. Bergson was a French philosopher around the turn of the century who had a very provocative view about what was real was always the becoming into existence of the now. And we will read some Bergson later on. And Bergson was certainly well known and thought about by people of Einstein's and Carnap's generation. Okay, Carnap goes on, I did not wish to press the point because I wanted primarily to understand his personal attitude towards the problem rather than clarify, the theoretical situation. But I definitely had the impression that Einstein's thinking on this point involves a lack of distinction between experience and knowledge. Again, there's an awful lot in that sentence, and I hope you won't mind coming back to that sentence when we will read more about from Carnap and Einstein and so forth, that Einstein is wrong because his thinking involves a lack of distinction between experience and knowledge. Okay, what does he mean by that? Well, he suggests in the last couple of sentences, since science in principle can say all that can be said, there's no answerable question left. Carnap was part of a philosophical movement that actually believed that everything that could be said in principle could be said by science and that there were no unanswerable questions. But though there is no theoretical question left, there is still the common human emotional experience, which is sometimes disturbing for special psychological reasons. Okay, so what are they talking about? And maybe a lot of people, a lot of us have had this experience, you know, late at night having a drink with a friend in college or something and wondering about these things. And if you haven't, you know, maybe I'll provoke you to, or Carnap will provoke you to. Okay, what's the basic problem? The basic problem is that we experience the world in time as a succession of moments. And that, however, as I just indicated, these moments disappear when we represent the world mathematically. That is, the mathematical representation does not come in the same form as reality. Time seems to disappear. And let me explain that time disappearing, because this is not an issue of quantum gravity. This is not an issue of general relativity or relativistic invariance. This is an old issue. The issues of relativistic invariance and the lack of simultaneity and the issues of quantum gravity and the wave function of the universe come on top of this issue. Okay? But this is the sort of scene of the crime, is this issue here. Okay? How does this happen? Okay. So the scene of the crime, for some people who think about this, goes back to Descartes and Galileo, when people first graphed motion. So they may have been, you know, graphing the position of a piece of chalk that's going up and down. X is the x-axis, is height. T is the time, is a function of time. And they would make an observation of where the chalk is as a succession of moments. Of course, they got more interesting curves than that, but okay. And the result of the experiment is a set of observations in time to which you draw a curve. And that's the result, and then you compare that to a theory, as I'll discuss in more detail in a few minutes, how we compare that to a theory. And the moments at which the observations were made plays no role in the, quote, experience of the succession of time. What you have is a two-dimensional piece of paper with two dimensions labeled, one of which is labeling the readings on a clock at which other measurements were taken. So what we have is a correlation between readings of some measurement of height and some measurement of time on a clock, and that correlation is a two-dimensional static thing that sits in space. And how could it be anything else? To be useful, it's time in the sense of something progressing and succeeding, it is out of it. If the result of all of our observations was to make a film, and every time we wanted to compare theory and experiment, we had to watch a film, it would be very inefficient. The whole point is that it's not a film, it's a picture, and it's static, and there's no time, therefore, in it. It represents measurements of time made by clocks correlated with other measurements. Of course, somewhere in there is a now. In fact, every point there corresponds to some now where in the sense of the flow of moments, but that plays no role. Okay. Now, I think you can make a pretty good case that that's the way science should be done. That is, and this is what Carnap was arguing, that is that what we're graphing is correlations between different measurements, in this case position and readings on a clock that correlate with time. And the graph is done once it's done. It exists static and eternal. We compare it to some mathematical functions which come out of a theory which are static and eternal. And the whole thing is not happening. I mean, it may be that it takes some time for us to do it, but it's not. Time does disappear from the description in the sense of the flow of moments. Okay, so that's the scene of the crime. That's the basic issue. Okay, let me now, I'm going to make a claim about that after a while just to be provocative, but for the way that physics has always been done for laboratory experiments, it seems like that's the way, that's a good thing to do. You know, Galileo and Descartes invented a very powerful methodology by, quote, spatializing time measurements or geometrizing time measurements and presenting them statically rather than having always to recreate the experiment for you or show you a movie of it. Okay. And this has developed into the basic methodology of laws of physics. And the key that I want to emphasize is the separation of phenomenon into laws and initial conditions. Because all the laws of physics that we deal with are not just generic statements about this must be true. They're laws in a much, they have much more structure than that. There's a common structure to all the laws that we study in physics, and they start with the idea that we can make a separation between what are the laws and what are the initial conditions. And I want to formally display that common structure because we're going to come back to it over and over again in class.
Initial conditions, you don't have laws.
But you can imagine laws without initial conditions. You can imagine there was one law that had, that just said where everything was going to be in the universe at which time, including the
name.
Well, I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
So I call this thing the Newtonian schema. It's a general framework that, you know, Newtonian mechanics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, string theory, supergravity, hydrodynamics, every theory that you deal with, electrodynamics, falls into the schema. And the key point is that we start by delineating a state space. And I'm presenting this now in this introduction because I'm going to use this language to frame the issues, and I'm going to keep coming back to class. So the first step in setting up a law of physics, the way that we've learned to do it, is to write down the state space, the space of possible states. So first we define the system. You know, we're interested in the state of the chip in the phone, or the position of this piece of chalk in this room, or all the positions of all the molecules in the air in this room, or something like that. We define a system, and then we define the space of possible states in the system. And we do that before any discussion of time is introduced, before any dynamics is introduced. So we do cleanly kinematics before dynamics, independent of dynamics. We discuss the state space of the system.
It's assumed not to change in time by itself. That's a big assumption. There are areas of science where this configuration space or the space of states does change in time. For example, economics. You talk to people in economics, okay, as an economy evolves through different systems, through different modes of organization, the space of possible states changes in time. Until you have a law that establishes what a public corporation is, there can't be an aspect of your space of states which is the possible corporations that live in there. Okay. In a different kind of society, you have a different space of possible states of the economy than in a contemporary economy. Okay. And it's completely useless to make a meta theory and make a space of states of all possible economies. At least, that's what the economists I know tell me. Okay. Or biology, the effect of, you know, the space of states that geneticists work with, okay, are highly dependent on the history. They are different depending on whether you're dealing just with prokaryotes or eukaryotes, multicellular or one-cellular organisms, etc. So we do something that they don't do in these other sciences, which is redefine the state space once and for all. And we believe we have the power to do that. Okay. Now, in classical mechanics, I'm really talking about the phase space, the pairs of position and momenta of particles or fields. In quantum mechanics, this state space is the Hilbert space. And so we do that first step. The dynamics is specified by giving a rule to evolve on the state space. I finally get to use my hockey stick. So the idea is that you give an initial condition. So any state can be enjoyed by the system at any time. So at any one time, if you make an observation, you could get any state in the system. Okay. You pick one as the initial state, either you observe it to be there or you prepare the system to be there. And then you have a law that gives you the evolution in time. And by the way, what time means in all the applications of this is as labeled by a clock, as in the little cartoon that I had here, that I had before. And that clock is always outside the system in all the applications of it that have ever been done, that have ever been carried out. So you have a time parameter which evolves you along a history. So the notion of time becomes the notion of a path through the space of states. A law, hold on, let me lay the thing out. A law is a rule to tell you which paths are allowed and which are not allowed. There are lawful paths and there are unlawful paths. Those that are allowed usually satisfy some equation, some differential equation, and we say those are physical histories or paths, and the rest are not allowed. And it generally is true that through every possible point or state in the state space, there's one and only one path going through it. So if you measure completely the initial state, you determine the future evolution. Okay. Sean, what I think was first.
I just wanted to ask an operational question. That's sort of, what about error bar in your initial conditions? Because it seems
sure
to me that, like, even in the context of Newtonian physics, that that is a way to distinguish the now from the past from the future. It seems that if I have errors on my initial conditions, then everything that comes after that, those errors are just uncertainty about the future. That's the future. The future is...
Yeah, so good point, but would you agree that this is what we do in theory?
Yeah.
In the connection with experiment is for sure, okay, an observation picks out some region here or some probability distribution here, and then there's a flow. And there are theories where the histories are insensitive to the choices of initial conditions. So it looks something like that. And there are theories where the evolution is what's called chaotic, which means that there's a tremendous sensitivity to the initial conditions. So all that's true, but and we may need to introduce that, but so far I'm not.
Okay. Yeah. So actually, two comments. The one comment is just related to what Sean said, is that as soon as you assume that you're allowed to do measurement, for example, quantum mechanics, which most people do, you actually distinguish the now from future and past, because there is only limited knowledge about the future and past. And that's perfectly contained in our laws of physics.
Yes. So something very, very, very good.
So an issue that we could discuss, actually it's not in the syllabus, but it is the notion of
time and low time just in the way of quantum mechanics. Let me see if I can fit that in.
Or even like the second of thermodynamics tells you that we have limited knowledge about
time. Absolutely.
And then the second comment was that in physics you always only look, do an experiment with a subsystem of the bigger system.
I'm coming to that.
As soon as the system around it changes a little bit, you will change both the state space and the laws of your particular system.
Yeah, hold that thought about subsystems, because I have a lot to say about that.
So, two comments. I mean, one problem in the physics, it would say that physics is a model of the nature, and then so since this laws comes from that model where they did it, so maybe we can generate another model that's completely different from this law that we have right now. Why is it possible?
Sure. This is the structure of a model. This is the structure of a model. By the way, I love it that you three guys are being very active, but everybody else please be active too and speak up. Okay, let me go on.
Yes.
I mean, very much theories are models. Okay. I'm going to make that distinction, because that's an important distinction.
And the other thing was me. So here you assume that we have a mistake, I mean S, and then you assume that okay we have something there, and then you define the dynamics by evolving this in the time that you define some example corresponding with some plot or something. But another thing that we have in philosophy is that intrinsic motion is kind of different from this. And we say that we have any state at all, and then we have kind of motion, intrinsic motion. And what's happened at the state is kind of different. And actually, we have any state. Everything is moving, and our...
I think I don't understand what you're saying. There's no contradiction here with the assumption that an initial point, especially in classical mechanics, is a position and a momentum.
Yeah,
so there is motion.
Yeah, this is one model that you try to use it as assuming the state and define the dynamics by this.
Can I focus? Okay. There's a class of theories that work like this. If you have one outside of that, let's talk about that later,
okay, sure.
And we will talk about it. Okay?
Sure, maybe. Okay.
I want to just keep focus on these because these include. General relativity, quantum mechanics, string theory, classical mechanics, etc., which are all
theories that we want to deal with. I'm very interested in possible dynamical systems that fall outside this, but that's the reasons that will become clear in a minute. Okay, so this is just more to apply this to an experiment. I already said this, where you find the initial conditions and then you apply it. Now again, there's this issue that the now has disappeared. It plays no role, as I think it should not play a role, but there's Einstein's disquiet that in the solution, which maybe represents the system that he's part of, the universe, there's no now. There's no representation of any particular moment. What's represented is the history. Okay, so, yes?
Why do you say that these laws defined with respect to a clock that's external to the system? I mean, that wasn't Newton's idea.
I'm going to withdraw that for a moment, and then I'll come back. Okay, thank you. So I want to emphasize that in laws that satisfy the schema, there are several senses in which are the cause of Einstein's disquiet. There are several ways to say it. They're related to each other. They're not all equivalent. There's this geometrization of time in which time is represented by a dimension of space, but by, you know, a dimension in a mathematical space. There's the notion that causal implications, causes that this event caused the next event, which caused the next event, in a mathematical model are represented by logical implication. That is, you derive by a mathematical calculation, which is using basically logical implication over and over again, a consequence of initial conditions and laws. So causal relationships are modeled by logical relations, and logical relations live in some abstract world of mathematical systems, logical relations, which are outside of time. Moreover, if the evolution is deterministic as it is in those schemes, if you want to discuss the value of an observable at some time, you can always, by using the equations of motion, relate it to the value of some different observable at the initial conditions. There's every property of the universe at some time here is actually a logical consequence and therefore a property of the initial conditions. So this, quote, nothing new ever happens. It's just development of the information in the initial conditions. In thermodynamics, there's a lot to say about thermodynamics, but in equilibrium thermodynamics, there's a basic postulate of ergodicity that averaging the system over time, the properties of the system over time, is the same as averaging over a configuration, an ensemble of configurations. So again, time is eliminated in the interest of getting predictions from thermodynamics. And the last thing, that the configuration space, unlike other sciences, does not itself develop in time. Okay, so these are all aspects of the issue that Einstein is worried about. And let me emphasize what I'm not claiming, is that the issue that Einstein is worried about is the same as or is even related to the issues that people in quantum gravity and cosmology worry about. I want to raise that issue later, but what I am claiming is that the arguments for timelessness in quantum cosmology and classical general relativity all sit in a context in which there were prior arguments for the elimination of time. And that will be important logically in sorting things out. Okay. Now, somebody mentioned subsystems. So now I want to make a provocative claim, which is my claim. So you can disagree with it. My provocative claim is that the kind of physics that fits within the scheme I've been talking about, which has been incredibly successful, and there's no criticism of it. It's been incredibly successful with a multitude of applications over, you know, enormous ranges of time, distance, and energy.
is, however, limited, and it's limited because all the successful applications of it were to descriptions of subsystems. Because I want to claim there's never been a successful application of that kind of physics to, quote, cosmology. And what I mean by a subsystem is that is the possibility that we can do experimental physics. And the possibility that we can do experimental physics means that we can go to a laboratory and set up a system as we like it, choose at least to some approximation the state in the configuration space, or the state space, which is the initial state. And we can do that over and over again. We can do it in different places at different times. So we can realize many, many copies. And because we can realize and experiment with many, many copies, it makes sense to distinguish initial conditions from laws. That is, we can do this. When I reflect on an amazing thing, which is just to incredible degrees of approximation, define systems which come in many copies, we can make a configuration space for that kind of system. We can find by experiment laws that they all satisfy, and differences between them are explained by being different initial conditions. So the operational meaning of the separation of physics into laws and initial condition, of explanation into laws and initial condition, the operational significance of that is that we can do experiments many times choosing the initial conditions. Or in astronomy, we have many, many instances of things. We have many, many solar systems, many galaxies, and so forth. So we can take advantage of the hugeness of the universe to study similar systems in many, many instances. And this is what gives operational meaning and power to the separation of initial conditions and laws. And I want to emphasize that because now this role of the time parameter refers to the clock used by outside the system. So now I'm ready to defend that. Let me say it in a weaker way than I've written it down, because Harvey is going to jump on me. And it's there are many cases in which the operational meaning of the time parameter is a clock outside the system. Okay. If the clock is part of the system, that represents special issues, and that's what we're going to spend a good deal of time in this class talking about, is what to do when the clock is a part of the system. Okay. Are you happy if I say it that way? Okay, we'll come back. Okay, so if you buy that, you'll also buy that all the physics we've done so far is approximate. In the language of contemporary quantum field theory, it's all effective quantum field theory. It's approximate for two reasons. One of them is that we idealize things to death. We abstract out of some complicated system a few degrees of freedom that we focus on and we study. And B, as long as we're dealing with subsystems, we neglect the interaction between the subsystem and the environment, which is the rest of the universe. Okay. So everything we've done so far is approximate. If we want to do better, because of the second reason, we have to, if we really want to make an exact physics, then we have to put in the interaction between, then we can't describe subsystems. Because we start with a subsystem, but there are gravitational forces and electromagnetic waves, etc. If we want a precise description of a subsystem, we have to include the environment it's coupled to, and we have to include what that's coupled to, and when we're done, let me just finish. What does that mean? Does that mean somebody's asking a question, or you've decoupled? Hi. Oh, you've just arrived. Okay, welcome, Dan. Okay, is that what's happening? Okay. Okay, good. Let's keep going, because this is a pivotal point. You don't see him, but we see him.
No,
they do see him. Good. We all see you. Welcome, Dan. Okay. He looks unhappy. Anyway, let me go on, because we don't have so much time. So a truly fundamental theory has to be a cosmological theory. And the point that I want to make to sort of close all these provocative remarks on is that we've never done that. Okay? We have never had a cosmological theory. Okay? General relativity may claim to be a cosmological theory, but in fact we've never tested, this is a long claim, but we've never tested the difference between applying general relativity to a region and applying general relativity to, quote, a whole cosmology. So we have to do something new. And then here are the questions. How do we construct a cosmological theory? Can it be based on this framework or not? A cosmological theory must include the observers, us in the universe, and does that mean that Einstein's issue of the place of the experience of the moment is pertinent in a way that it wasn't when we were doing theories of laboratory systems? If we choose to take on the point of view that time is not fundamental, then if the observer is part of the system, then we have to account for the observer in a cosmological theory, and then do we really have to address Einstein's issue? Okay, so that's the end of my provocative remarks. Let me have a few questions, and then I'm going to last 5 or 10 minutes to sort of indicate where we're going.
I want to just ask, because I don't really understand why you think it's so important to have a cosmological theory, because in a sense we can only really operationally know what's inside our light cone, right? So this cosmological theory principle extends further than that, and why?
I want to understand the claims that I will want to make is that the issues of the nature of time are very different, both from a philosophical standpoint and from a physics standpoint, whether we're doing a theory of a subsystem or not. And this we're going to develop technically. So let me make the technical claim: the general relativity in a region with a boundary or with asymptotic boundary conditions, like asymptotically flat, okay, is not just a little different from general relativity for a closed cosmology. It's very different as far as the issues of what are the observable quantities, what's the role of time, is very different from general relativity with a closed system.
And I'm interested, because we have a general relativity which claims to be a cosmological theory, I want to understand that claim. Okay?
I want to understand if it succeeds. Okay? B, I want to find out what's the right theory of nature, and I believe the right theory of nature should be a cosmological theory because it's all of nature. Okay. And C, our cosmology friends are giving us fantastic observations and very fantastic, if they're true, explanations of those observations that rest on ideas about quantum cosmology, like inflation. And I want to examine those
and see if, you know, so an interesting question, you know, for example,
there was this essay question on the internet, on the Edge website, you know, what have you changed your mind about, published on New Year's Day. And Paul Steinhardt, who's one of the inventors of inflation, says that he's changed his mind about inflation. He says he's changed his mind about inflation because you can't make sense of the quantum mechanics of the inflationary universe, okay, and you can't make sense of it for reasons that have a lot to do with this issue of systems with no boundary versus systems with boundary when you get technically into it. Okay, so it affects it affects the plausibility of the claims made by inflation versus the claims made by other approaches to cosmology, which is in terms of contact between experiment and theory, the best stuff we've got. So those are all reasons.
Okay. You guys have raised many questions, and I have 5 minutes. Let me see if there's somebody besides you guys who has questions. Yes.
What if someone were kind of a jerk and basically did the backwards thing that they developed a method to turn every non-cosmological theory into a cosmological theory through some complicated mathematical process? What would happen to the problem with that? Other than
saying, I don't know that that's possible, but okay. I don't know.
Okay.
Let's relay that, leave that as a question. Okay. I want to, in the last few minutes, I want to talk about where we're going. I hope that this was fun and provocative. This is not the way most of the class is going to be. Starting next time, we're going to talk about the Hamiltonian dynamics of fully constrained systems. If you want to quantize a theory, you have to treat it first as a Hamiltonian system, because the route between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics goes through Hamiltonian dynamics. And there are issues and subtleties that arise in the Hamiltonian, in the description of general relativity as a dynamical system in the Hamiltonian formalism, that are key for this issue of time and key for this argument of time's disappearance. So we have to study that. We can't have an informed discussion of these issues without studying that. So that's the next two times, the general theory illustrated with a class of models called Barber-Bertotti models that I'll be introducing next time. Some of you are very familiar with them, but some of you are not. The next two times, we'll talk about general relativity as a constrained Hamiltonian system. That is, we'll give the phase space in the Hamiltonian for general relativity. That used to take a course of its own, but thanks to Ashtekar and Flibanski and Sen and the approaches to general relativity that they develop, we can do it, I believe, in 6 hours. Even if you know just a little bit about general relativity, assuming you know at least about Maxwell's equations in a relativistic formulation. And then we're going to talk about the issues of observables in general relativity. And I think that you all have the syllabuses, so it goes on from there, but that's I think, enough for the moment. Now, something that we didn't do, but we better do quickly, is make an email list. So I'm going to pass around email list. And I'm going to mention, so I did not succeed before this in finishing putting together my reading list, which I apologize for, so I want to email it to everybody. But let me point out some of the things that will be on it for this first part of the course. So absolutely key and the best text for this Hamiltonian approach to general relativity and related systems is a book of Dirac. It's interesting that sometimes the first publication of something is the best treatment, and this is, in my opinion, the case. So I know a lot of people in this building have this book. You can get it within 4 days on Amazon for $7.95 if you want a new copy, or $3 if you want a used copy. So even though it's an old book, it's readily available. And I really suggest, if you're taking this course or serious about these issues, to acquire a copy. The textbook of Carlo Rovelli on quantum gravity is half a textbook in quantum gravity and half an essay, a long essay on the issue of time and what's observable in theories of gravity. And I will certainly be recommending specific sections to read in it. You can buy it from Cambridge University Press, but you can Google Carlo Rovelli, go to his website, and download a beta version of it.
You know, I should be telling you to buy it, but since the beta version is available online free, you can do that. And I strongly recommend it. If you're reading Dirac and you want a book which is an order of magnitude longer with lots of examples, then there's the book of Hinault and Teitelboim, Quantization of Gauge Systems. It's very complete. It has every possible example and every possible twist on every possible example. It's good. It's complete. I don't know a cheap way to get it. If you try to get it on Amazon, it's $105, I think. So I will not be doing anything that relies on it, but it's a good reference. Finally, when it comes to the technical material, so the material in the next several lectures, I'll be repeating myself because 2 years ago, I gave a course which was an introduction to quantum gravity, and there the focus was on quantum theories of gravity, so the focus of topics was quite different, but several of the lectures coincide. So, for example, a lot of the material in the next lecture will be very much the same as the material in the third lecture of that course. And I'm saying this because the people at Perimeter know you can get all the courses on Pearsa. And if you're interested, that's its Pearsa number. You can just go to the Perimeter website and search, and you'll find it. So that's only if you really like punishment. You don't have to listen to me twice. So that's what we'll be doing next time. And let me emphasize again, people who are taking the course, please email me or come to see me and make an appointment, because I want the research projects that come out of this course to be good. Obviously, they'll differ in emphasis, whether you're a philosopher, a mathematician, or a physicist, but I want them to be good, solid, graduate school level research projects. I want you to get started on them as soon as possible, so please come visit me and let's talk and find a good project.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, of course, your own original crack of the problem will be fine. Okay.
But there's a lot of, you know, it could be a serious critique of certain philosophical issues, etc. Okay. Or it could be a research problem within physics. It could be a study of a model, of a quantum cosmological model, for example, which emphasizes the role of observables. There are many different things it could be, okay, besides your own approach to the problem. Okay. And if you have your own approach to the problem, then, of course, I'm interested, and I'm sure everybody else would be interested, too, but that's not expected. If we can find right away, if it's fatally flawed and you know that, you should not be working on it. Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry to be short today. And I'm going to have to run away because I have to get to Montreal. But thank you, everybody. You know, this is a class.
Thank you.